The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix podcast. Tune in today.
And this is New Zealand only has like 3.5 million voters.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can meet 20 people a day.
Yeah.
And make a good impression on them, yeah, and they each tell 10 people, yeah, which is legit, you know, which is reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's then over time, and then those each of those 10 tells two.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Over
yeah.
time, you know, people do go, oh, that John Key's actually quite a good dude.
Yeah, I think he's actually a really good guy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he came to the AMP show and, you know, pulled my ponytail. Welcome to Gone By Lunchtime. It's Wednesday, October the 4th. Advance voting is underway. 55,000 people voted on Monday. Excited people, probably. Or maybe just wanting to get it out of their lives forever. Exciting campaign. The sun is shining across the country. Election day itself is 10 days away. Morena, Ben Thomas.
Morena.
Kia ora, Annabel Lee Mather.
Kia ora.
And hello to you, producer Sam.
Hi.
Well, last night was the press debate in Christchurch for a crowd of 2,000, except that it wasn't, of course, owing to a battle playing out in the body of Chris Hipkins between the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, and an army of immunoglobulins. We wish Mr. Hipkins well. Get well soon. Meanwhile, in other recent developments, the campaign has taken on an ugly, sometimes violent tone. We'll talk about that shortly. Winston Peters is roaming the land being very Winston Peters-y.
I thought that was what you were talking about.
What?
With the ugly violent
tone. No, don't tell you. Well, maybe. We can
that's a wrap. One more podcast in the can.
What else has happened? We had National's fiscal plan. A whole bunch of policies will earn away as we, you know, with advance voting underway. It doesn't seem like we've got any big bazooka policies left. We haven't had a poll since the last podcast. Not a big poll.
We've
had
there one some, today.
Yeah, there'll be one variant tonight, Wednesday night. And I think you sort of sense a little edginess among certain people in the campaign. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays. We have had a few electorate polls, though, mm-hmm. So I think we'll come to that as well as we continue our journey through this episode of Gone by Lunchtime. Where should we begin? Well, the relentlessly positive campaign has arrived at last, courtesy of Chris Hipkins' rapid antigen tests. And he is shacked up in an Auckland hotel probably until Friday in a critical week of the campaign. It seems like terrible luck. He seems like a luckless Prime Minister, luckless Labour leader. Apart from everything else.
A luckless instead of a Luxon.
Luckless versus Luxon. And apart from everything else, they've tried so hard to avoid talking about COVID. You know? They've had nicotine patches for whenever you mention COVID. Must not mention COVID. The only time they mention COVID is as a reason that something couldn't be what it should be. And I've mentioned before that maybe they should have just chucked that out the window and started talking about COVID. Anyway, here they are now with Chris Hipkins doing Zoom press conferences, Zoom town halls, giving everyone these terrible lockdown flashbacks. You know, it's not, you don't need to talk about it. There it is, right in front of you. It feels very COVID. I don't know. Is this all bad?
COVID's making a little bit of a mini comeback, isn't it? Heaps of people I know have got COVID right now. I think the old relaxation of the 5 days, maybe a little, because you'd think coming in, you know, the weather's warmer, we're spending time outside. I wouldn't have thought that we were ripe for a sort of spike. But
this is the first time we've returned to the epidemiological expertise plot for a while.
Yeah.
We were, providing lots of expert advice some time ago.
But, terrible both for the timing and for the association. Obviously hampers, what I think we were talking about earlier, have been very short campaign days from both teams that are really more stage managed for TV and social than for actually getting out and sort of, connecting with and touching voters. It just seems very unfortunate, particularly as I think Labor and certainly Hipkins looked like he had a bit of a spring in his step. That may have just been that he was getting sort of pseudoephedrine without us knowing, but
mojo.
Yeah, but he certainly had a spring in his step, I think, after the debate last week, and was making really lame jokes with the gallery, saying I think Jason Walls asked, "Are you the king of zingers?" And he said, "I'm the king of gingers." Yeah. Said, enough for me to
love a ginger joke.
Call a halt on the election campaign until we can figure out what's going on. But they really did seem to have a bit of a spring in their step. Certainly, I think
maybe
it fired
should,
up.
Maybe
the
he
base.
Should say like last time. He should say we've decided to put the election back by a month.
Yeah,
because because I feel a bit sorry for him anyway that Chris Hipkins was delivered. He made this joke at some event that he found out that Jacinda Ardern was standing down and that the election date had been decided. She announced the election date, then she announced she was gone. And he might have put it in a different time. Anyway, what do you think, Annabelle? Is there any silver lining out of this for Chris Hipkins? Is there a bit of a sympathy vibe, anything?
I think there might be a little bit of a sympathy vibe. I've been reflecting back on the 2020 election, which felt so much less divisive, less resentful. And I think that's because we were all still sort of wearing our team of 5 million T-shirts then. So I don't know if it's, obviously it's not great in terms of he had some wind beneath his wings after the last leaders debate, but it may not be such a bad thing to remind people that COVID is out there without saying COVID is out there and without saying it that Labor actually did a pretty good job during COVID without having to make the case for it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, they haven't though, have they? There is that, look, I'm not suggesting that it necessarily would have made a difference overall, but there are moments when Hipkins has started talking about the response to COVID, the bits that we were world leading, and he seems again like he's kind of suddenly confident, suddenly channeling capability in the sort of anyway, whatever. I'm not going to bang on about that. I've banged on about it before. Let's talk about the press debate. We had the debate that wasn't.
Yeah.
We had we had that kind of infantile squabbling about who was the better debater. You're a better debater than me. I'm a better debater than you. And now that's morphed into an infantile squabbling about who's turning up for a debate and who isn't.
Wait,
turning
didn't
up
it
for a
start
debate?
Off like you're a better debater than
Yeah.
And there was like, no, you are a better debater.
You're not showing up for the debate. No, you're not showing up for the debate. So this is, it's this great meta debate with the tenor of kind of 11-year-olds.
This is the kind of debating I'm into.
It is, I guess
so, low stakes apportionment of moral culpability.
Yeah.
No, you are. The two things can be true at the same time, can't they? You can't pull out of a debate that hasn't been set down. So, Christopher Luxon. So Christopher Luxon hasn't pulled out of a debate, but he hasn't shown an enormous enthusiasm to make it happen when there was, efforts made to reschedule it, because he's winning.
Yeah, that's right. Donald Trump isn't sort of sharing the stage with anyone in the Republican primaries. He's happy to sort of...
Ben Thomas compares Luxon to Trump. Just going to note that down for the online post. Karen.
You can sort of see both of their sides, right? But you know, the reality is that Hipkins apparently couldn't make it. I think there was some sort of talk about, oh, maybe they could do it by Zoom, but you can't really have sort of one person in person and one person by Zoom. And then I think they've said that they had offered to put Grant Robertson up. Well, okay, sure, but only if Nicola Willis gets to debate Chris Hipkins at the final TV1 debate. I mean, like, let's. what are we. Are both the leaders just allowed to choose better debaters than themselves to put up, or what? Like, it's sort of like Roman emperors and their champions, you know? It's like, you know, Shannon Halbert and Dan Bidwar sending out Hillary and the campaign manager to fucking go at it at the bakery.
Like an online caboodle. Did you do any of those during Zoom? Or, you know, some where they do quizzes and things, like some sort of online event?
Yeah. Look, they should have. I don't understand. If Hipkins was fit to debate, they could have. Robertson and Megan Woods could have rolled him in a Zorb onto the stage.
Yep.
And
suit?
Yeah.
Just was ventilated piping outside the Christchurch Town Hall. I mean, that would have been an event.
Yeah. Or Grant Robertson wearing a GoPro and a mic.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But, you know, any of these sort of lesser kind of, you know, kind of tweaks, I don't think really does it. And yeah, you can see why Luxon sort of doesn't really want to mess around his schedule. They've already got, you know, they do have a debate in the sort of dying days of early voting on Thursday. Do you necessarily want two debates in 1 week? Probably not.
I mean, the other thing is that, you know, a relatively small target campaign being run by National. Luxon hasn't been hiding. He's done plenty of interviews, but there's also plenty that he hasn't. He, for example, has declined to take part in an interview with Moana Maniapoto for Tower with Moana. He's declined to do an interview with Tova O'Brien for Stuff.
Oh, really?
Okay. He's declined to do an interview with Mihirangi Forbes for Mata.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also declined so far to do an interview with the spin-off either for...
He's coming into the pod next week.
Well, he's welcome. Very dare he
Christopher Luxon, Mr. Luxon, you're very welcome. The invitation remains open to come on this podcast. You can choose who you want to talk to.
If you dare.
We could do one together. Us and Mihi, we could do it.
Oh, that's
he gets
good.
Up at 5 a.m., right? You know, we could do it at 5 a.m., doing it at midnight. Surely there is some time in the day. If you're going to be Prime Minister, our audiences want to hear from you, don't they? Seriously, though, right? I mean, that is...
That's right. And, you know,
come on.
Number one on Apple Podcasts.
Number one on all the... Yeah. I mean, this, you know, this podcast has 10,000 listeners now, which is not shabby. And I think they deserve to hear from the next Prime Minister, the likely next Prime Minister, don't they? What do you think, Sam?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. It's just a little survey there of listeners, the only one so far to have heard it. You instead, Annabelle, had Tamapotaka on.
Mm.
I listened to that. It was a very interesting interview.
Mm.
How do you think he went? He's obviously in an interesting spot because as a former lawyer who's been involved in various iwi and waitangi discussions, cases, he's trying to balance some personal views with the party line, which everyone does, you know. I think that's fine. That's not to have a go at him. You have to do that, right?
That's right. You know, Ingrid Leary, when asked about a capital gains tax, says, you know, well, our leader has ruled it out, but that's just his opinion. there's always this kind of balance.
Well, the electorate might rule him out. I mean, we'll see. It's the subtext there. But he was also, I thought it was interesting on the point on co-governance where he was asked about whether co-governance could work with public services, and he said no. And then he was asked whether that was always his view, and he said, "Not always my view."
He's like, "I can't pick a day,
like
my birthday."
But he sounded pretty plausible. He sounded pretty plausible in the interview.
I think it's a difficult they're difficult questions for Tama because not only was he a lawyer, but he did like a master's of law at Columbia University. Yep. So he's like a, you know, he's a person who understands the mana and the tapu of the courts and the tribunals and all of those things. So for him to be referring to the English version of the treaty when in international law it's always the indigenous version, that's the that is referred to, and, you know, to try and say that they did and they didn't cede sovereignty, Ngāpuhi, when the tribunal has found that they didn't, is interesting to watch. And, yeah, I think he did, you know, a reasonable job of speaking to those issues, but really the issues that we should have been speaking to his leader about. What I thought was really interesting is that National haven't released any of their Māori development policy yet, and we're just days away from the election, so how Māori are supposed to make an informed decision about where to put their vote when there's no, you know, nothing to refer to when it comes to Māori development, Māori economy, any of that stuff is kind of weird.
The co-governance question is interesting, and it was sort of addressed by, I think it was addressed slightly better by a couple of people in the Kaupapa Māori debate that TVNZ held last week. I think it was JT, Tamahiri, actually said, you know, my problem with co-governance is who invited the Pākehā in. You know, and I think that that would have been, I think, a better way for Tamapotaka and also Luxon and National to actually frame this sort of thing, which is that, you know, co-governance as a mechanism was actually, you know, was a halfway house. It was designed that way.
It's a compromise.
But, yeah, it's a compromise because, you know, the Maunga in Auckland were, you know, some of the most visited spots in New Zealand by the public and by tourists and things like that. They're very special to the people of Auckland, and so the compromise that was reached between Tamaki Makaurau Iwi and the Crown was that, you know, there will be co-governance between the council and Iwi, and that would be a way of keeping them open to the public and making sure that the council contributed to that public good. But, you know, in terms of things like social services, you know, what most groups want is actually devolution. And, you know, they do, you know, now full sort of, you know, however you conceptualise, and I think Tama touched on this in the debate, however you conceptualise sort of mana motuhake or tino rangatiratanga, you probably won't, you know, when you're using public funds, then there'll be sort of 100% kind of self-determination, right? Because there'll always be some sort of question about, you know, when funding or how much funding or whatever. But the more autonomy you sort of give and the less time you have for sort of, I think it was Nadimu Blair on the sort of pundit panel afterwards said, you know, he and Ngāti Whātua sort of saw co-governance as a bit of a distraction, you know, fighting over who gets to sit on a board with seven white guys, you know. And what they were more interested in doing was sort of, you know, having control over social services themselves for their people. And I think these are all sort of, I think that this is actually sort of the direction that the Nats are going in, but they, I don't think that they're articulating it well.
Well, they're now talking about Iwi delivery and health.
They've been talking about it for a long time. Yeah,
well, that was kind of interesting because when Mihi, you know, asked him about the issue of tax justice and, you know, inequity in the tax system, you know, he said that key drivers for Māori in terms of inequity were in education, health, and what was the third one? Education, health, and I can't remember what the third one was. But then at the same time, you know, they want to close down Te Aka Whai Ora. So it's interesting to watch how you resolve all of those inconsistencies.
Let's talk about Winston Peters, if we may.
Are we allowed to? Have we got? Have we consulted our lawyers?
He is just, you know, floating around the water at the moment. I was in a lift with him at News Hub.
A lift or a crypt?
The other day. It was bright. It was like, it felt like that, you know, in Pulp Fiction where you open that briefcase and all the gold. The whole thing was just absolutely illuminated with the aura of Winston. He's walking on air. He's loving it. You know, he was, and so he was, you know, this is where we're at. Thanks to thanks to National Party's strategic geniuses.
That's right. Won't share the stage with Christopher Hipkins, but we'll literally like vacate it for Winston Peters.
Well, you know, I mean, he was the. I mean, admittedly, you could argue maybe they don't have a massive audience, but they certainly have an outsized influence. The two weekend political shows, News Hub Nation and Q&A, he was the lead interviewer on both of them, you know, which would have been sort of unimaginable sort of 3 or 4 months ago. He might have been given a, you know, a bit towards the end, but just anyway.
And especially this close to the election.
And what maybe is the most important weekend right before advance voting opens?
I mean, look, you have to hand it to him. He has perfected timing, you know, in terms of peaking at the right time in a campaign.
Mm. Well, he was helped, though, wasn't he?
Well, no, I know. Yeah, it's you know, maybe it's one of those things where you make your own luck, you know. But it's just extraordinary that the full final week before voting started, because you know you talk about you know these policy announcements. Every policy announcement now, apart from you know, I think there's two kinds. There are the ones that are just re-slicing and repackaging previous announcements, which we've seen from most parties.
Sometimes just reiterating, saying we're still going to do it, but we're going to do it quickly.
But it's also sort of recombining and sort of saying, have you looked at it from this angle, you know? What if you put this light on it, you know?
Yeah, put an alliterative
What if we announce it at a farm?
Call it a package. You know?
And then there are the ones, you know, that are obviously so cobbled together and written on the back of a napkin, like the, you know, we'll partner with Aldi to come to New Zealand one, and, you know, and so for that final week, you know, before advance voting starts, the stage was just handed to Winston. It was his week. And what's so incredible about it is, you know, and you never know, because with the audience he's quoting, those weekend shows, if they did anything, probably bumped his vote by a percent or something.
But, by a percentage point.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you make of those interviews?
I've never seen anything like it.
I mean,
they were magnificent.
Like the bombast and the belligerence. And it was just kind of, it is kind of someone playing a parody of Winston Peters almost at times.
I've honestly never seen anything like the Q&A interview where not only did he not seem to be able to explain his policy, it seemed he often didn't actually – there was no policy.
Well, this is
there were literally just some clauses on
some
a website.
Bullet points.
Yeah.
Some bullet points.
Some sentence fragments that had been somehow put on a website.
One of the fascinating things I thought about that was that I think it was quite smart on Jack Tame's part, as he said, right, I want to talk about policy.
Yeah.
You know, right at the top. The questions that Winston Peters is normally pretty agile and – almost persuasive at doing the full Muldoonist counterpunch on, will you work with X?
Yeah.
Is your bottom line Y? Will you rule out Z? In this, it's like, what is your policy? How much will it cost? Mm. And he came back with, how dare you go Philadelphia lawyer on me and Cinderella-ize demonstrably, sunshine.
You know,
all this stuff. And it's like, he just literally asked you what your policy was and how much it would cost.
I liked how that Jack reminded him that he had been complaining in other interviews and debates that he wasn't getting the opportunity to discuss his own policy and was being able to comment on other people's. And then when Jack asks him those very, very simple questions about his own policy, he literally has no answer.
I mean, with the prison one, we went from...
And his hands were shaking too. It's like, what is going on here?
It went from, it will be a 3,000-person prison and it will be built by the prisoners themselves to, actually, there's plenty of room and we'll just rejig it and they can probably go in Hawke's Bay.
I know.
And so it won't cost anything.
It's fully and we'll get Mexico to pay for it, isn't it?
But this is the thing, like, we're not even clear on whether it's whether the new prison is a new prison or whether it's just reallocating space. I mean, brick by brick,
we will relay our gag-only prison.
He couldn't explain what funding residential care meant.
I like it.
What the funding was. What
I like it when he said that he didn't say that he didn't know what the numbers of gang prisoners were, but he said that information wasn't available, and Jack said, yes, it is. It's 2007. 2,700, and he's like, it would be at least 3,000.
Yeah, actually, it would be 3,000 because I talked to a prison guard. Is he talking about that former New Zealand first MP? What was that guy's name? Ravi? Was it?
It's like I asked corrections, you know. It's like, I know a prison guard.
And then I think the threat about becoming Minister of Broadcasting.
Oh my God, that's so not even funny.
In every area, in terms of disorganisation, lack of knowledge about his own portfolios, in terms of the insults and the bombast and the evasiveness, and in terms of the personal threats, on every level, like that was like a teenager, you know, getting on the equaliser on their stereo. Everything was up to 10. I haven't seen any interview like that on any axis.
And yet, before. The people whom Winston Peters is courting here, they gave him a good telling off, didn't he? He gave that upstart a good telling off. The MSM, constantly trying to interrupt the MSM. Here we go, at last, someone who's willing to give them a bit of what for. That's what they hear, right?
So, oh, for sure, yeah.
I mean, or are we better than that? And there is some extent to which some people who might have been floating towards a New Zealand First as an insurance policy.
I think both is true. I think there'll be some people who feel like emboldened and hard done by that interview. And I think there'll be others who are perhaps sitting on the fence between New Zealand First and ACT, or maybe New Zealand First and Labour, who may not vote that way. Now, can I just acknowledge that back in 2020 when Jack did an interview with Winston Peters, I smack-talked him on this podcast.
Who, Jack Tame or Winston Peters?
I smack-talked Jack.
James.
Jack.
James, good. Yeah, good.
And I take it all back. Okay. And that was a masterclass in interviewing. And I thought he handled it with so much dignity and mana, despite some of the comments getting made about, you know, him being lousy and a dirt merchant. And I think Amateur Hour is actually a really cool name for Q&A.
The Jack Tames new podcast.
And we should note, you know, Jack has made a conscious decision to do very tough interviews with the party leaders during this election. Luxon, you know, pretty difficult interview with him. Hipkins really got held to account for pretty much everything that had happened for the 5 years before he was Prime Minister and for the 9 months where he was. There was certainly no sort of singling out of Winston.
Hats off to Rebecca Wright
Rebecca Wright.
It's great to see Pākehā journalists asking really tough questions about co-governance and Te Tiriti and all of that sort of stuff.
And was it Tim Murphy who said, we saw something, was it Mihi on Twitter, said we've seen something that some of us thought we would never see, which was Winston play the victim card and say, how dare you as a Pākehā ask me, a Māori man.
Been here thousands of years. Asking for special treatment.
I've had enough of this woke identity politics, crying ageism, pulling the race card. This is woke extremism from Winston Peters, and it must stop.
That's going to be the next policy announcement. It's the woke jail. The jail for the wokies or the woke affiliates.
So are you putting the woke jail or the gang jail? Or both, actually. The woke branch of the Mungrel Mob.
The woke jail is going to cost $50 million in business plans and policy documents, but they'll be written by the inmates themselves.
It'll be solar powered and
just endless, endless, endless discourse.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Couple of other important issues out there. We're at the point in the life cycle and the electoral cycle where we discuss whether or not there is potential for National Party and Green Party to come to an accommodation and a governing arrangement under what's now colloquially described as a teal deal. Is that something that's on the cards, Ben?
No.
Annabelle?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say no.
Okay. Meanwhile, there is some speculation as well surrounding the seat of Ilam and whether or not the National Party, in an attempt to provide itself with some insurance from an electoral standpoint, might do a little bit of a nod and a wink or a cup of tea with Ralph Manji in the interests of bringing Top into Parliament. Is that plausible, Ben?
No.
Annabelle?
No.
Okay. Let's talk about the campaign a little bit. This is the question of whether or not how ugly it's become. We had Hanarafti Maipi Clark's home was invaded. That were merged over the weekend. Pretty horrific, pretty abhorrent. Then it had already been, there'd been, I think, before that, Angela Roberts, the Labour candidate in Taranaki King Country, got sort of confronted and slapped on the cheeks by an angry punter. We had then the National Party reveal that they had threats from gangs. Is this an ugly, is this a troubling development, Ben?
I mean, it is always hard to evaluate from, you know, individual sort of discussions. You know, there were, I think, remember back in 2014, Hone Hadaweda's electorate office got shot at. And particularly when things happen outside the major centres where there's a lot of journalists, you know, sometimes they almost sort of have this kind of dreamlike quality where you're like, did that actually sort of happen?
It's true, there were a bunch of electoral offices that got vandalised at the last election too.
Yeah, so look, I think by and large it's the same, but I think certainly there are more crazies around than there have been in the past. I think that, you know, we see it as a bit of a truism now, and I think unfortunately we just sort of have to accept that, people have been radicalised, by cooking their brains online, yeah. Particularly the sort of conspiracy theory sort of stuff. Carl Mokadana is the sort of, you know, kind of the kind of comical manifestation of, you know, something that is a bit darker. I don't think that I think there's a couple of things. I think that the campaign has taken on, in terms of, say, you know, Crown Māori relations and Te Tiriti stuff, I think it's kind of in that sense, thanks to Winston Peters and ACT, it's become one of the sort of darker campaigns since probably 2005, I'd say, probably the worst since then. So I think there is that sort of a level of vitriol and kind of, I think, disrespect and division that we haven't seen for a long time. You know, and on the other hand, I think that there are, you know, more, disturbed individuals out there, you know, people who have really just sort of wound themselves up into a state where they are more likely to do kind of, you know, things that, you know, would have been, you know, even more outliers, you know, a few years ago.
I think Ben's right. And the difference between now and 2005, of course, is the way that we use the internet and the forums and the echo chambers that we're able to create. And, it's deeply troubling to think that a young person like Hannah is being exposed to this sort of, you know, home invasion and violence. But what's deeply concerning also is the response to it that I've seen on social media, where you have high profile people who are questioning her honesty, who are kind of implying that she deserves it and she's not telling the truth and she's going for the sympathy vote. And these are often people who, you know, present themselves as being very much concerned with women's rights and women's safety and all of that sort of stuff when it comes to, trans issues. And yet when a young person, a young wahine, is feeling threatened in her home because she is a woman, because she is Māori, because she is young, there's like zero empathy. And, you know, it's just a really disappointing campaign in that regard to see the division, the misguided resentment, you know, after being... After last election, where again I feel like there was a much greater sense of unity and empathy towards other New Zealanders, you know, the resentment being whipped up against Māori beneficiaries, all of that stuff is, you know, it's really disheartening.
I mean, we'll probably come to talk about this in the weeks to come, but it does capture some of the we're going to keep going after the election, perhaps, but in terms of accessing the campaign, there is something quite deflating, cynical, deleterious. I don't feel as though we've shown ourselves across the board as a magnificent country in this campaign.
This campaign it's really playing to our ugliest stuff. I think it's a lot, we talked about this last week, but I do think that a lot of it is to do with the cost of living and people looking for someone to blame and express their anger and resentment towards. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like the worse people feel, the worse they behave. And it's so disappointing to see politicians weaponising that against communities that are really vulnerable.
Do you remember in Christchurch, Leanne Dalziel, the former cabinet minister and Labor MP, talked about 2005 as being the election where she first felt as though the parties were actively talking about this is what we do for you individually, rather than any grander vision for the country or for society or for communities or whatever. And that does seem like that this time too, doesn't it? And I mean, you pointed
what's
out
in it
the
for
time,
me,
Ben,
and she said
in it for you.
Yeah, she said it was the first time someone had ever come up to her and said, "What's in it for me?"
And I actually sort of, when she said that, that kind of twinged my memory. That was, I think, that was the first year that I was writing a column. I think for the NBR,
2005 was
2005. Yeah. And I remember actually writing something about that because, you know, I think I was probably about 27 at the time or something. And prior to that, every election had been sort of almost kind of like tough love. It was sort of like unemployment's at 8% or whatever, you know.
Right.
We didn't, there wasn't a surplus for the first 20 years of my life, you know. And it was all sort of basically like, you know, here's what you've got to do to knuckle down and, you know, we'll, you know, try and get us out of this mess. And 2005 was the first election that I could remember. I think it was about the third or fourth that I voted in, third maybe, fourth. And it was the first one where there were things on offer. You know, there was interest-free student loans. Me and everyone I knew had massive student loans. And there was the $25 tax cut, which of course, you know, back in 2005, that'd be sort of the equivalent of $40, $45 today. And it was almost this kind of giddy feeling, you know, when it felt like people were sort of vying for our votes. I was like, ah! And I think there's sort of two things from that. The first is that I think it's, you know, I think what Annabelle's saying is completely right, that when economic growth starts to stall or when people feel they are individually going backwards, as has happened with inflation, you know, eroding people's real incomes, then people start to see society and the economy as a zero-sum game. You know, if I'm missing out, somebody else is getting something. You know, that's all coming from the same source. They're getting something because I'm missing out.
Mm.
And that makes it particularly fertile ground for sort of race baiting, you know, saying, oh, co-governor, oh, special privileges. Where are those special privileges coming from? Yeah. They're coming from my $10 a week eroded purchasing power. You know, it doesn't make logical sense, right? But that's how a lot of people start to see it.
The corollary of election being about you, me, is what are the other people getting? The envy is the other side.
Yeah, that's right. And
It's interesting. Sorry to interrupt you, Ben, but there's been so much talk about the politics of envy this election. And actually, the reverse. It's feeling envious and resentful towards, like, poor people or marginalised communities or Māori. not the other way around.
And I think that, you know, there's actually sort of twin legacies of 2005, but they've sort of, like the terrible final season of Lost, they've split into two timelines. and the first is the kind of resentment, race-baiting part of, you know, the 2005 election, and that's being played out with ACT and New Zealand First and, you know, Te Pāti Māori on the margins. And then that middle, you know, that sort of the kind of low rent sort of venality of like what's in it for me is kind of being played out with Labour and National, where over the past 18 years or so, that all of our elections since then have actually been by and large contested by the major parties in this incredibly narrow band where it's basically 20 buck tax cuts on National side versus a $20 or $30 tax credit or maybe some childcare on Labour's side. And that's sort of it, right? You know, Thomas Coughlin said, you know, arguing over the leaders' debate, National and Labour seemed like sort of bickering parents who had to talk through a mediator. And our elections since 2005 have almost been like, you know, divorced parents, you know, sort of, you know, offering you better pocket money than the other one. And this is really the most dead behind the eyes election I can remember, in terms of the lack of a bigger vision, but also the way that, you know, the politicians are saying their lines sort of perfunctorily as they always do, but this time it's so hard to believe any of them even mean it, you know.
Oh, well, on that cheery note, I did say we'd talk about the polls, so let's just quickly race through some of the electric polls, which at least provide a little bit of theatre in particular parts of the country. The first that I wanted to mention was Auckland Central, which was over a week ago, but it is interesting in that it gives Chloe Swarbrick a lead, but only by 2 points. Mm. This is a Courier poll for Taxpayers Union. Only by 2 points, 38 to 36 over Mahesh Muralidhar, which is interesting. And I think quite a few people had sort of thought, oh, Chloe will walk that because she's been so visible and generally appears to be well liked within Auckland Central, so that is on. It seems the swing is on.
People really did seem to kind of forget about the swing in discussing electorates. You know, yeah. I mean, we sort of I think Sue Moroney talked about this on RNZ this week. You know, we said that, you know, the electorate vote is the party vote to a very large extent. Now, obviously, in different electorates, you have a different baseline. But the way that the swing happens,
yeah.
You know, it means that even Chloe pulled only, off the only miracle last time.
You can't avoid that swing, but you can limit it sometimes, can't you?
That's right. But the idea that Chloe would be sort of, you know, dead set, sort of, you know, embedded in Auckland Central after her win last time, well, that ignores that there was a massive swing to the left last time, and there's a big swing back to, you know, National in particular this time. So, you know, I would say a poll like that would probably rally, you know, the Labour rump to kind of get behind her, and so she'll probably be safe. But, you know, it does show, you know, the strength of the kind of National forces at play.
Yeah, I agree with Ben.
I also agree with Ben. I also agree with what he's about to tell me about Tamaki, where we had a poll last night released, which again showed a 2-point lead, which again is within the margin of error, as it was for Auckland Central. And this time in Tamaki, the affluent East Auckland seat, where there's a battle on the right between Simon O'Connor of National, who's been challenged by Brooke Van Velden, the deputy leader of the ACT Party, coming with a strong socially liberal line at the strongly social, one of the most, probably the two or three most socially conservative National MPs. And that put O'Connor, Ben, 2 points ahead of Van Velden. That's on as well.
That's really on. So that's not so much about any kind of National swing, because you're talking about, first of all, a very safe centre-right electorate. But
I think National will win the party vote in that one. That's my prediction. They'll get 150% of it.
But yeah, and it's interesting to look at this. You sort of think, you know, will this be a little bit like, you know, in the Wellington Central with that News Hub poll, which I think showed Tamitha Paul about 2% behind Ibrahim Omar.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that would have probably given people confidence to kind of swing in behind her, and that would, you know, that would probably help her. I tend to think if the under, you know, the quote unquote underdog or the non-incumbent or the minor party figure is that close, I think a poll like that probably helps them. Mm. But look, you know, really pitched battle. You know, ACT had leaked some polling, I think, or Matthew Hooden purported that they had leaked polling that it was very close. Yeah. We've been hearing that out of ACT for some time, so Simon O'Connor might actually feel this is a pretty good result if it's still very close, you know, a week and a half out.
Yeah.
I've spoken to lefty ladies in that electorate who are like, I can't believe it, but I think I'm going to vote.
Voting for
I'm going to vote for Brooke just to get rid of Simon. And it's because of the way Simon's perceived by women who are concerned about women's rights.
Last one, Hauraki Waikato, which is the seat held by Nanaia Mahuta. And there was a poll again out last night which had Nanaia Mahuta on 36% and Hanarafati Maipi Clark, who we've spoken about before, the 20-year-old Te Pāti Māori candidate, on 32. So there's 4 points in that. That's close. We've also discussed before how difficult it is to poll these seats. But Annabelle, is that on? And Nanaia is electorate only. She's not on the list.
An absolutely remarkable result for Hana. To be fair, I don't think anyone would have picked it. I think everyone thought Hana would do really well. She's, you know, she's a mokopuna who is much loved all around the motu and has a high profile and is well respected. But I don't think anyone thought that the race would be this tight. And, you know, credit to her because Nanaia's faced some incredible adversaries in the past, like Rahui Papa, who's like, you know, a very esteemed Tainui leader. So for Hana to get so close, I think Nanaia will be genuinely worried, and she looked like she was worried in the debate last night, right. I have to say. And, yeah, like you say, if she doesn't win the seat, she's out because she, you know, she hasn't put her name forward for the list. She wants the mandate from her people, and just a remarkable result.
It's alive in quite a few of the Māori seats, isn't it? Mm. I can't remember when so many of them might be in play.
We've seen this before though with the polling with the Māori seats, and whether it's
not in Hauraki Waikato.
That's true. But I think, you know, I mean, how long have we been predicting that Te Tai Hauru is going to go back Māori? Yeah. Difficult to say. I mean, Ikaro Arafati looking very good for Labour, interestingly enough.
I'm not surprised by that.
No, neither. But it's, I mean, look, it would be an incredible achievement if they could knock off Nanaia. I mean, front bench Minister of Foreign Affairs, you know, she's got to be one of the longest serving MPs in the House now.
She's the longest serving woman in the House, 96, she went in.
I mean, that would be an incredible achievement.
All right. Well, it's good to have some interesting electorate battles to keep an eye on as we crawl our way towards Election Day, 10 days to go. Thank you, Annabelle. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Spin-off members, especially. Back soon.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi. Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-off Podcast Network.